fresh hell is this?
I like it. It smells like crime, punishment, and the urine of homeless men and women.
Talk about a panty peeler.
Says the man holding the plastic ass gina. Hey, what are we doing here anyway?
Hey, where's the shitter in this joint?
What? I couldn't hear you. I've got an ear infection. I'll figure it out later.
Oh, you're a real fucking narcissist, you know that?
I'm king of fuck mountain. Woo!
I've grown tired of your jibber-jabber.
Where's that fucking lunatic?
Who the fuck are you?
Now there is the surly, mean-spirited bastard that I know and love.
Too hot to handle and too cold to hold, you're listening to The Casey Ferguson Show. As the title of this show would infer, I am Casey Ferguson. In the interest of time, I'm not going to flap my fucking gums too much. I'm going to keep the open of this show short and sweet. I'm running around like a chicken with my fucking head cut off, trying to get everything together for The Casey Ferguson Show Listener Appreciation Party, which, as of this recording, is tomorrow night, Friday, April the 10th, at Overtime Sports Bar in Kingston, Ontario. We'll be celebrating 2 years of The Casey Ferguson Show, so I want to thank you for that. If you need any information about that show, check out CaseyFergusonShow.com or Facebook.com/TheCaseyFergusonShow. My guest on this episode of The Casey Ferguson Show is Neil Affleck, star of the Canadian horror film My Bloody Valentine. Released in 1981, My Bloody Valentine has gone on to enjoy cult status amongst horror fans, and Quentin Tarantino himself has called it his favorite slasher film. Neil would go on to become an animation director for The Simpsons and Family Guy, amongst others, but for this part of the conversation, we're going to talk about My Bloody Valentine. If you would like to meet Neil in person, he'll be a guest at Hero Fest in Kingston, Ontario, Saturday, April 11th and Sunday, April 12th. The event will take place at the Holiday Inn, located at 2 Princess Street in downtown Kingston. For a full list of guests, more information, or how to purchase tickets, check out herofest.ca. This is the first part of my conversation with Neil Affleck, star of My Bloody Valentine. All right, I'm Casey Ferguson. You're listening to The Casey Ferguson Show. I got Neil Affleck on the phone, star of My Bloody Valentine and former animation director of The Simpsons and Family Guy. Welcome to the show, Neil. How you doing today?
Pretty good. Thanks for the invite, Casey. Nice to speak with you.
Oh, hey, anytime, man. I appreciate you taking the time to do this. I know you're a busy fella, and, you know, you got a family and whatnot, so I appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, probably not as busy as I'd like to be.
Well, that's probably true for a lot of us. But
busy enough for an old guy, so, yeah.
Well, I mean, it's all relative, right?
Perfectly relative, yeah.
Now, Neil, you grew up in Montreal, but you now live in Toronto, so who are you rooting for? Are you a Habs fan or a Leafs fan?
Let me put it this way, Casey, and I know you live in Kingston, which is halfway between, and you probably have to watch what you say, because you have people from both particular religious affiliations there. I grew up a mile from the old Montreal Forum.
Oh, wow.
Do the math. I have the CH tattooed on my butt for life, so. I think that should answer your question as to whether I'm a Habs fan.
Yeah, I think that suffice to say that that answers my question. Well, I mean, I grew up a Leafs fan, you know, unfortunately, but man, I can't watch hockey anymore. I watched that Leafs-Boston game about 2 years ago where, game seven. Oh, yeah, I just said, fuck it, that's it. I'm not fucking doing this anymore.
You know, I will say this, as long as we're talking hockey, which is a perfectly good place to start any Canadian conversation, I lived in Toronto now for almost 15 years. I brought my daughter up here. There are no hockey fans in the world like Toronto fans. They've just been through so much. And they keep, you know, rise again. They keep coming up to it. So, you know, like I say, I'm a Montreal guy, but I've just observed, a lot of my friends here are Leaf fans, and they just have been put through the ringer so many times. You mentioned that one game in question. If it's possible for a Montreal Canadiens fan to have a small feeling in his heart for Toronto fans, I watched that game and I thought, oh my God, there is suffering happening right now in the greater Toronto area. So.
Oh, absolutely. I'm sure I drank myself into a stupor after that one.
The whole game has changed, of course, since I'm old enough to have vague memories of watching Maurice Richard, the Rocket, play on the old Hockey Night in Canada black and white television. So I have vague memories of that. So I know I'm dating myself, but the game has really changed since then, obviously. But it's still fun to watch. It's hockey. What the heck? It's sort of in our blood here, isn't it?
Absolutely. Along with the beer, usually. Now, here's a question for you as a Habs fan, and you remember watching Rocket Richard play. Did you ever see the biopic they did?
I remember seeing it briefly, and I think think I watched it partly en français on when it was posted on YouTube or something. Or maybe what I saw was a compilation of the night he scored 6 goals or something, or 5 goals, whatever the hell it was. So, no, I can't claim to have seen it in detail, though. Bits and pieces. I don't even know who did it or who starred in it or anything. So.
I don't think it was anybody that was, you know, a big name or anything like that, but a really excellent film, actually. I certainly recommend it to you.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'll chase it down one of these days.
Well, let's talk My Bloody Valentine here, Neil.
Sure.
I was kind of intrigued to find out that you got a cold call for the film, but what is even more interesting to me is that you got let go from the previous film and you still got that call. That's kind
of... Well, yeah. I was a very green actor at that time. It was about a year out of theater school, or even less. Maybe it was like 6 months. I'd done 3 years at what's called the Montreal the Film Theater, Dawson College Theater Training Program. And I got a call to audition for this film called... I can't even remember it now. It was about a celebrated case where a Canadian family had kidnapped their son out of the whole Moonies cult. I forget what the film was called, but it was being done by quite a celebrated American, or Canadian filmmaker, I beg your pardon, Ralph. I won't even remember his last name now. The long and short of it is it was, I did a good audition. They cast me in one of the best character roles in the film. It was a huge break for a kid like myself who was just out of theater school. And with, I should say, almost no experience in front of the camera. And then we went to work on it, and I proceeded to do an incredible face plant on the thing. I froze up. I couldn't work with one of the lead actors. It just, the whole thing became a bit of a nightmare. And the director had to replace me on that. He was very good about it, all things considered. I wish I knew his last name. It's awful. But, you know, it was pretty tough row to hoe. And that sort of happened. It was, you know, I guess I don't do anything halfway. It was a very spectacular crash and burn. I still remember. The funniest part of it, I can laugh about it now, is I remember just being so frozen and not even being able to kind of open my mouth anymore that the camera operator started laughing. Anytime you, the DOP, who's got a camera trained on you, breaks up and starts laughing, it's probably not a good thing, and that's where we ended up. Anyway, it was a bit tough, but you know what? You learn from that sort of stuff, and I think I did come away with a few lessons learned. God, I hope so. And almost immediately after that transpired, I got this offer from the Montreal company to come in and do a reading for a horror film that they were doing. So I went in, and, you know, I didn't really have any great expectations about it, but I heard a few things about, you know, English Montreal is a small town, and so I heard a few things about it. I did an audition, and just had a feeling right from the start they wanted to work with me on it, so that turned out to be the case. And, of course, there were a bunch of my friends and some folks from the same training program as me, or just people I knew from around town who ended up. It was very much a Montreal project in terms of the cast and the producers and writers, well, writers from LA. In terms of the crew, it was very much, it was kind of split between Montreal and the Maritimes, Nova Scotia, which made it sort of an interesting English-French vibe, and a really good crew on it, and Montreal director, of course, and DOP, you know. So that was it. I just kind of went in and did I didn't have any expectations. I found out, they called my agent, said they wanted to work with me, and I guess I should have been more excited about it. But as I say, I was just sort of coming off my spectacular crash and burn on the previous project. So it was a little bit sort of like, yeah, well, all right, let's do this now. And that was it, really, to be honest with you. And I'm sorry if I'm anticipating a question you may want to ask down the road in the interview, but, you know, I did the film like with everybody else, and about 2 or 3, 4 years later, I decided to pack it in as an actor and went to film school in Los Angeles. And it isn't that I forgot about it, but it just became part of the past for me and part of the 6 years I spent as an actor. And, you know, I stayed in touch a little tiny bit with one or two people, but not that much. And then so, you know, when we learned about, by we, I mean me and the other cast members, director George Mahalka and the DOP Rodney Gibbons, when we learned learned about 5 or 6 years ago that the project, the film had become sort of, well, I guess, a cult classic, or you use that. I was astonished. I was gobsmacked. I had no idea about that. I'd heard that they were remaking the film. That astonished me, too. I mean, you know, that someone would want to do a remake of My Bloody Valentine would never have occurred to me, you know. But, you know, it was fun. We were 2 months on location in Sydney Mines, Nova Scotia. Cape Breton, I should say. It was fun. Of course, we were all kids. I mean, we were people in the cast. I think our ages ranged from 18. Ellen Udy was 18, and Paul was the oldest. I guess he was about 30, 31 at the time. I call those kids right now. From the privileged position of somebody who's cracked 60, I guess I'm allowed. I don't know.
Fair enough. Well, yeah, I'm 31 right now, so.
Well, there you are. There you are. You know, it was fun. I mean, I didn't have that much, you know, acting experience, at least in front of the camera, when we went down there. So I think Paul was the most, Paul Kellerman was the most experienced of us actors. Ellen, I don't know that she had really any, she'd done a few, everybody had done, had dabbled, you know, so, but there was a, I mean, I think there was a nice vibe back then that we kind of took for granted. I've worked on other stuff since where there isn't as friendly a vibe, and you do notice the difference. So
there's a lot of camaraderie on the set then.
Well, yeah, and you know, the funny thing is, as I mentioned, you know, fast forward 33 or 30 years, and you know, a bunch of us who live in the Toronto area got called out for a showing of the film, and George was there, of course. And
wasn't that for Rue Morgue?
That exactly. Yeah, I don't know if you do you know those guys. Or?
Yeah, actually, John W. Bowen from Rue Morgue is a regular on my show. He has a segment called The Chop Shop.
Oh, okay, good. Well, it was a Rue Morgue guys who organized this, and as I see, so I think George was in Toronto then, and it was nice. We came out. I went with my current partner, and Laurie was there. I run through the list of people who were there, but we were all kind of astonished that the theater was filled up, and it was filled up mostly with folks in their late 20s, early 30s, most of whom wouldn't have been alive when we made the film. And the topper, and then we went and we signed stuff afterwards, and it was like, we all looked at each other kind of like, whoa, what's this about? You know, because everybody had moved on, had lives, had families, had careers, done this, done that, had ups and downs, you know, everybody has ups and downs, but I don't think any of us were really cognizant of the fact that this film was important to a lot of people. For me, the tipping point was I met a young couple, I guess they were about 25, 26, 27 maybe, who had driven up from southern Pennsylvania, like from someplace around Valley Forge or like, you know, way south of Philly, and they'd driven up for this showing.
Oh, wow.
One night showing in Toronto at the Bloor Cinema, and I was like, whoa, that made me sit up and take notice. So, you know, who knows why? To this day, I'm not quite sure why it... I have a few theories about it. I think it's a well-made film. I think, you know, just cinematically, I've worked in animation for years. That's filmmaking. Good filmmaking is good filmmaking. I think a few decisions, key decisions that the producers and George, the director, made, and Rodney Gibbons, the DOP, was a big part of this, too. Decision to go for a working-class feel.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you know, initially going into it, I think they had the idea they were going to get all us guys in there to clean up our Canadian accents. I think at a certain point they just gave up on it. Okay, just let them be Canadian. Who gives a flying?
No doubt about it.
Yeah. So, but there are a few things that it does stand out in contrast to some of the other genre films that were made back in the day for being a little bit different. And the special effects, you know, the whatever they call them, the kills, the thrill kills, are very well handled too. And you know, that's really what those films are about. They have to deliver the goods in that department,
mm-hmm.
or nobody comes out for them. So, and I think they were well done. Even though I have to confess, I'm not a fan of the genre myself. So,
right. Do you have a favorite kill from the film?
Jesus, do I? I'd have to think about that. I have a favorite actor in the film, and that's Keith Knight, who we lost about 5-6 years ago now. He died at the age of 51, far too young. He was the guy who played the big, is it Cletus they call him? Damn, you see? You know you're talking to him.
Yeah, I know you're talking about the cat with the big mustache there.
Yeah. No, I think, I every time I see the film, his performance gets stronger and stronger. He was the one of us, I think, who really nailed the whole working class guy thing, you know. He just embodied it, you know.
All in the staff.
It's probably... The stash didn't hurt. But Keith was from Northern Ontario, so yeah, he came by that, honestly. He was a marvelous, marvelous actor, too. So
yeah, he did a great job in that film, absolutely.
Yeah, and, you know, he doesn't jump out or stand out. He's just there. But you take Keith's performance out of that film, and it's going nowhere, as far as I'm concerned. So, but in terms of the special effects, there, I think one of the most stylishly ones, you know, there was the bar guy. What they call them, Happy or something?
Yeah.
Yeah, the way that whole thing was orchestrated, what I thought was very clever and very well thought out. It works in terms of the guy's character. There's some others, and of course the guy who played the cop too. Oh God, this is awful. He's a jazz singer. I should have the list in front of me with all these names. If I'm going to drop names, I can't remember. It's going to be
well. Hey,
bad.
As long as it's you know, not the wife's name, you're probably all right.
Yeah. So anyway, I really was astonished, and I'm still astonished today. I mean, me and Laurie are going down for this event that we talked about. We'll meet a few folks and stuff. The fact that people sort of still come up for that sort of event is quite surprising to me. But, you know, happy to be part of that. So.
Well, I got one for you, Neil. Did you know that My Bloody Valentine is Quentin Tarantino's favorite slasher film?
Yeah, I heard that. And again, you know, all I could do is shrug and scratch my head. He is notorious for watching anything ever made about 4 or 5 times and analyzing it. So, well, bravo. That's all I can say. You know, he's made a few films himself, that guy.
Yeah, call me kooky, call me crazy. That kid might have a future.
Yeah. He'll go places.
So. Yeah, stick with it, kid.
Yeah.
Now, Neil, you play a little bit of folk music, so have you ever learned the Ballad of Harry Warden just for shits and giggles?
No, I never learned it, but I, about 2 years ago, we went to an event, as I say, you know, the people who live in the Toronto community who are in the cast, and some of the creative folks, George is living here now, and a few of the other people, went to a social event about 2 years ago, and then the writer of that song showed up, and I met him for the first time. So it's actually a nice tune. I like the tune. It's well made. It's sort of in the whole kind of tradition of the murder ballad.
Yeah, I think it really puts a good exclamation point on the movie.
Yeah. And they, I hope I've got this right. My understanding, I think I heard this from George Mihalka, is that that was a late addition to the film, the song. Somewhere when they were kind of, it was a complete kind of frenzied dash to get the film cut and mixed and everything ready for the release. The release date was a hard release date. Somewhere in the madness there, they decided, you know, the ending needs something here. And so they commissioned somebody else whose name I can't recall to write the tune. And it's a good one. I like the tune. Now, I haven't learned it myself. I'm not a quick study learning other songs. So.
Gotcha. Well, maybe I'll pick it up and we'll jam it one of these times.
Yeah. No, it's, you know, I do like folk music. I do like the blues. As I mentioned to you, I play a bit of blues harp myself. That's my genre. I know it's my 8th bracket. I took, what was the film entitled Llewyn Davis about the folk scene in New York?
Oh, yeah, from the Coen Brothers. Yeah, that's a good film.
Brothers, yeah. My daughter, who's 18, is a huge fan of the Coen Brothers. So I said, Christmas a year ago, I took her out and said, oh, it's the Coen Brothers, you'll love this film. So we went out, we watched it, and of course there's all this story about the struggling folk singer in New York City, and then the introduction of Dylan at the end and that whole thing. So on the ride home, I said to her, you know, when I was your age, that music that they played was considered cutting edge. It was the most exciting, innovative music in the world. She just looked at me like I was nuts. Not her own musical taste. She's more cold, whatever it is, cold.
Well, as Dylan would say,
he would say that, I bet.
Yeah. So. Well, who are some of the blues and folk cats that you like? Like, you know, are you a Little Walter fan, being a harp player?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, all the classics. I mean, I should put in a plug for my teacher here right now, Al Lerman of Fathead. Al is the harmonica and sometimes horn player, sax player, and also the manager of a Canadian blues band by the name of Fathead that has been around for 40 years. Al's been playing since he was a 14-year-old kid hanging around the blues clubs in Toronto. I really had no training at all in the harp until we moved in. Me and now my ex moved in, bought a house in the burbs in Toronto, and found out that there was this guy called Al Lerman, who was one of Canada's top harmonica players, who lived four houses away and gave classes. So
hey, there you go.
I checked it out. Now, I don't, I haven't seen Al in a while, but you know, he's a marvelous musician in his own right. And he actually makes a living at the blues in Canada, which is a pretty neat trick if you could pull that off, and he does. But he was also a wonderful teacher. I was very fortunate to be able to. He would do workshops where a whole bunch of people sat in his basement. I actually got some, was able to incorporate some theory into my stuff. So kudos to Al, wherever he is. He's probably out on the road right now with his band somewhere.
Oh,
he's not far. He lives out towards somewhere between Toronto and Peterborough, or out towards your way in Kingston. So, I mean, through Al, I got to meet probably the top harp players in Toronto would come into his workshop, and so I got to trade a few riffs with those guys. So. But yeah, all the classics. I mean, you listen to the Chicago guys, and you know they still do stuff that blows you away, just in terms of the feeling and the skill and the musicianship they bring to it. So anyway, as I say, I'm an amateur musician, but I understand you're a musician yourself of some long vintage. All I'll say on that front is that music takes you to places that only it can take you to when it's working. So
absolutely,
it's an important part of my life. You know,
well, I mean, it led me to this, too. It's,
right.
You know, kind of funny how it all worked. While I was waiting to get on air we have a high school station here in Kingston, which is where I started. And while I was waiting to get on air, I formed my first band and ended up doing the radio training a couple of years ago. Once I begged my way on air, I pestered the station manager for a couple of years till I got on. And, you know, I took the course for a couple of times. Like, I peer tutored. I came back and helped out after I'd taken the program and volunteered in the summers. And then I was teaching the kids even after I graduated, and then unfortunately my teacher passed on, who was a musician as well in town, a blues guy. He played sax. His name was Austin Lowe. I thought about it, and I was having fun doing the music thing, and I thought, well, you know, I can't say what I want to say on the radio. I can't play what I want to play on the radio. I think I'm going to go do the music thing. And then, you know, after, you know, 15 years seeing nothing but highway signs and taillights, you know, for the 15 years or whatever, I thought, you know, I kind of like to do radio again, but I couldn't really figure out an outlet. And then I thought, well, why don't I just do it on YouTube? And then that turned into starting a website and having it available there. And it's wild. I mean, it's still music related, but I don't think that I would be, like, not that I'm thinking that I'm great or anything, but I don't think I would be as good at this had I not spent the time out there on the road as a musician, you know?
Well, clearly it informs everything that you do. An experience like what you described. My partner, Lynn, knows folks who were in the bluegrass scene back in the day in Toronto and were out on the road with bluegrass band, and I sit around talking to these guys, and you know, it sounds like your experience was similar, Casey. It's pretty rough way to live. You know, even if you're young and have all that energy, and you know, as much as you love the music and performing and stuff, it takes a chunk out of you doing that. But I think you come away from it wiser and with a broader understanding. You know, if you're able to make a little bit of music and connect with people that way, that's really something special. That's something to be treasured. Oh, by the way, I just Googled them. A song, I believe, was written by Paul Zaza.
Oh, okay.
At least he did the music for My Bloody Valentine. So I feel terrible not being able to remember his name anymore. But you know, that's why Google is there. So
putting boots to asses and emptying glasses, you're listening to The Casey Ferguson Show. That was the first part of my conversation with Neil Affleck, star of My Bloody Valentine. I'd like to thank Neil once again for taking the time to be on The Casey Ferguson Show. I will have the rest of that conversation with Neil on a future episode of The Casey Ferguson Show, in which we'll discuss his work on Family Guy and The Simpsons. Casey's code word for this episode is Warden, as in Harry Warden, the killer in My Bloody Valentine. Or a warden in what a politician might call a quote-unquote correctional facility. To the rest of us, it's a fucking prison, but whatever. If you are near Kingston in any capacity this weekend, I hope you'll drop by my listener appreciation party on Friday, April 10th out at Overtime. Or maybe I will see you at Hero Fest on Saturday, April 11th, or Sunday, April the 12th. Failing that, I will catch you on the flip side. Remember, if music be the food of love, play on. Till next time, this is Casey Ferguson, over and out.